Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
It's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast, and today I'm going to be talking to Dr. Morrigan Schell, who is a professor in the Department of Health and Human Performance at Middle Tennessee State University. And today we're going to be talking about why we do things every single day that we know are bad for us, but we keep doing them, and why it's so hard to actually change and do the right things. And we're going to talk about his theory, which he called the disconnected value model. Before we meet Dr. Schell, let me give you some of his background. As I said before, he's a professor in the Department of Health and Human Performance, and he's also a professor in the Department of Psychology at Middle Tennessee State University. Dr. Schell has been a professor of performance psychology with specializations in sport and exercise psychology and wellness program development for 29 years. He has authored 120 research articles in scholarly journals, with 5 currently under journal review. He's also authored 11 book chapters, and he's the author of several books, including Applied Exercise Psychology, A Practitioner's Guide to Improving Client Health and Fitness, Sports Psychology, From Theory to Practice, Concepts in Fitness, A Balanced Approach to Good Health, and Aerobics for Fitness. His current research is focused on validating the disconnected values model in exercise and wellness settings. This model provides an intervention framework for promoting adherence in replacing unhealthy habits with more desirable positive routines, such as exercise and dietary changes. Dr. Schell founded and directed MTSU's first employee wellness program. He's a member of the Society of Behavioral Medicine, a fellow with the American Psychological Association, Division 47, Exercise and Sports Psychology, and a member of the Stress and Anxiety Research Society. Now, let's welcome Dr. Mark Schell. Mark, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Great. Thanks very much, Howie. Glad to be here.
And I want to remind the audience that Mark Schell is a professor at the Department of Health and Human Performance at Middle Tennessee State University. And today we're going to talk about why we do things every single day that we know are bad for us, but we keep doing them, and why it's hard to stop and do the right thing. And we're going to specifically talk about Mark's program called the Disconnected Values Model. So, Mark, my first question would be, your research concerns how we need to stop unhealthy habits and replace them with new, healthier routines. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. We are in trouble as a society, and of course, we're getting diseases far earlier in our life than we should be. And we do indeed conduct ourselves in a way that's self-destructive. We do things every day, as you said, that are unhealthy for us, and the bottom question is why. There have been a lot of interventions out there to try to change health behavior, and researchers report these interventions at conferences and in journals, and the results are just mediocre, actually. We're not all that good at getting people to stop their unhealthy habits. I developed a model based on years of working with clients and trying to change health behavior, especially exercise behavior, and promote exercise, and to some extent changing dietary habits. And I found that the one missing link in a lot of this research and a lot of these consultancies in trying to change people's habits is attention to values, that we live a life that's disconnected or misaligned with what's really important to us. And so the disconnected values model is based on the fact that if we recognized this disconnect, this misalignment between what we feel is important to us, our core beliefs, what we call values, and the negative habits we bring to every single day of our lives, we recognize there's this disconnect, this misalignment, this inconsistency, and that the consequences of this inconsistency is actually quite unacceptable, given the long-term harm it does us. Then people seem to be more receptive to what we call an action plan to change those habits.
Mm-hmm. When you say negative habits, can you delineate, you know, the typical big-time negative habits that people have?
Yeah, absolutely. Anything that is viewed as counterproductive to high quality of life and leads to poor health. So certainly examples would be a sedentary lifestyle, mm-hmm. Lack of physical activity. I just don't mean going for a walk between your home and your car or taking a brief stroll outside. I'm talking about really engaging in exercise that improves muscular strength, improves cardiovascular efficiency. There is a science to exercise. And because we were not created to be sedentary, but rather we're created to exert effort to be physically active, that's part of our biology. We're literally counterproductive in the way we live our life. We've got to be physically active, at least more so than we are. So inactivity is certainly one negative habit. Another one would be lack of sleep or proper sleep, getting to sleep too late, getting up too early, getting fewer than 7 hours sleep a night is the usual norm. Most researchers view as the threshold of proper from improper amount of sleep. Certainly eating big portions of food and not exercising in direct result of overeating is leading to obesity. And all that taken together is very self-destructive. So the lack of proper nutrition and dietary habits, poor physical activity, a lack of proper sleep, and lack of hydration. We don't drink enough water, for example. And overstress. All of these are examples of negative habits.
Mm-hmm. Your model, the disconnected values model, how can people actually apply this model to their daily lives?
Well, first of all, we need help to apply the model. We can do it ourselves, but it's a little help more helpful if you have some sort of consultant or someone who's quite, someone to whom you feel accountable. It could be a clinician or a mental health professional. It could be a personal trainer. It could be a spouse. Typically someone to whom you feel accountable where you feel that the changing your habits is something you generally want to do, but you need to be led along the way. And we call that social support. There's a way where we respond to people to whom we feel accountable, to who we think is important. And usually, these are folks who know how to go through the model. Primarily, how we were talking about, acknowledging the reasons or benefits of these negative habits. We gotta start with what are your negative habits, and we have a checklist for that. And why do we do it? We don't do anything that is so-called unhealthy unless there are benefits to that negative habit. And we have to acknowledge those. There are good reasons, benefits of not exercising. You know, the amount of effort and discomfort and the sweating and the heavy breathing and maybe the expense of buying good athletic shoes or exercise equipment, not enough time in our schedule. Which, by the way, is a myth. I'll talk about that in just a little bit about the not enough time excuse. Mm-hmm. But clearly there are benefits to every negative habit we have, or we wouldn't do them. But what about the costs, short-term costs, and then long-term consequences of those negative habits? So we have to start with acknowledging the balance between costs, consequences, and benefits of why we even do these things.
Mm-hmm.
Then we go to the values. A values checklist is out there and say, well, it's really important to you. Here's a list of 40 values, core beliefs that you have, most people have, that they view as very, very important to satisfaction, high quality of life, good health. What are your most important values? And I ask people to name or check 5, unranked, doesn't matter which one's first and second, but what are the 5 most important values of this list of 40? So people now have this list of values about what they view as very important to them, their core beliefs. They have this list of costs and benefits of this. And then we have the negative habits listed. The next stage is to get them to look at disconnects. This is, we're getting to the heart of the model.
Mm-hmm.
What are the inconsistencies between the values you just checked off and the negative habits you bring to your life every day? If, for example, you check off something called health, that's a value. Because having good health is very, very important to you. But you have lack of exercise in your life. You're not exercising regularly. You're not physically active. Or you're overeating, or not drinking enough water, or you have a short temper, a short fuse, you're impatient with people, you're overly stressed, you're not sleeping well. All of these are performance barriers in negative habits that are inconsistent with the value of health. If you check and acknowledge a disconnect, an inconsistency between any of the 5 values in any of your negative habits, here's the bottom question. This is the core question of the whole model right here. Is that acceptable to you?
Mm-hmm.
Can you continue to live the rest of your life with this inconsistency? If the answer is yes, that's just the way who I am, I don't ever want to exercise, I hate it, I don't want to be active, I like eating a lot of food, I don't care that I'm obese, that's just who I am, and I'm just gonna let medical science, help me out, when I don't feel well, or when I get, diabetes, you know, that's just the way it is, or it's in God's hands, so it's not my responsibility at all. You get that too. If people feel that disconnect is acceptable, I don't go there with them. I don't mess around with, because people are not going to change. They're going to live their life and then die eventually. based on that misalignment. If, however, they say, you know what, I never thought of it that way, that the disconnect is absolutely absurd, I feel my family's important to me, yet I'm not looking after my health, and I'm not going to be around to see my kids grow up and become a grandparent, see my child graduate or have this great job. My legacy is going to be tarnished in terms of what I'm going to leave behind after I'm gone because I'm not looking after my health. If the inconsistency is unacceptable given the consequences involved, then people are more receptive to making change.
Hmm. You know, it's interesting because I've had many people in the office who smoke cigarettes, even though they know that it's unhealthy. And actually, one guy I confronted, and he told me that it takes a brave man to face cancer. That was his answer why he didn't have to stop.
Okay. Well, you know, people can rationalize, and there is something in the clinical psychology literature called irrational thinking.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And irrational thinking is exactly what you just said, you know, mm-hmm. where people, here's another irrational thought. Well, you got to die of something.
Mm-hmm.
So I can keep smoking or keep getting fatter and fatter, not take care of myself, get diabetes, and live a shorter life. And that's irrational because that is self-destructive. We are not on the planet to die. We are on the planet, we are a species of survival. And maintaining the species. So premature death is actually quite counter to our very existence. But people will rationalize it, and they are not ready to change. And this is why we haven't talked about this yet, but I contend very strongly that a lot of people who follow unhealthy habits and know they're unhealthy are in need of clinical intervention. I'm not saying they're crazy. Don't get me wrong on that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many, many psychopathological issues out there, like depression and other forms of mental illness and irrational thinking and low self-esteem, just examples, where people are not in control of their destiny, not in control of their habits, and feel they don't deserve to be healthy and happy. So, yeah, the clinical psychology is, in my opinion, going to be more and more recognized as a way to get people to change their behavior. Because the way people are thinking is not rational. It's not understandable from an intelligent point of view.
Yeah, I'm trained in CBT, and it's basically what I do in terms of my practice. And you're right that irrational thinking is you know a core issue in many pathological life situations. But it's very difficult to get people to change.
It is.
I think that, you know, your earlier point that, you know, there's got to be a payoff. I believe that, you know, my contention is that nobody changes behavior unless there are consequences.
That's exactly right.
And so.
The consequences have to be more important than the so-called benefits.
People, as I think they're able to forestall looking at what really is down the road because it's not in their face right away.
You know, what you just said is so incredibly important because one of the key questions about all this is why do we do things, and you said this in your introduction, why do we do things every day that we know is bad for us? And one of the reasons we do that, or two, actually, one is that the benefits seem to outweigh the consequences of those negative habits, so the benefits of that huge hamburger and all the trimmings and the french fries and the Cokes and all. So there are benefits to that versus the consequences, and that's number one. Number two, and something you just said, and that is that the benefits are realized quickly, short term, but the consequences are 10, 20 years away.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to heart disease or cancer, diabetes, and of course creeping obesity, which often takes a couple of years to reach quote fruition, which means people successfully become obese. That's the deal. So we are, not very good about, delayed gratification as a species. We really need. And Americans are worse at this than most of the planet, by the way. We are a culture of immediate gratification,
mm-hmm.
not much of a culture of delayed gratification. So, for example, it takes 6 weeks to get a reasonable increase in your physical fitness.
Right.
How many people are going to be patient enough to get past the years and years of self-abuse of being inactive to give themselves that 6 weeks of training so they start to really, really feel better from exercise, which is delayed gratification? Versus, well, I'm going to try it now, and oh, it didn't go well, and it's uncomfortable for me. I don't like being seen in a fitness club, being half undressed anyway with my shorts and all that. I don't like it. I'm going to stop. So again, immediate gratification seems to be at the forefront of our thinking, whereas we really need to delay it. And there are some researchers out there who say that's part of our personality. Some people are better at delayed gratification than others.
So I blame Sesame Street.
You blame Sesame Street because of a sedentary lifestyle?
No. Because if you remember Sesame Street very early on, and it's been around a long time,
yeah,
they changed every like minute or so. They changed. So,
oh, I see.
So there was never any reason to develop any sense of, delaying gratification because they short-circuited it.
That's a great point.
So it's like,
that's a great point.
Everything was changed. Boom, 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 boom. So the generation that started with Sesame Street, and of course it's tongue-in-cheek, but
yeah.
I believe on some level they were trained to believe that you're supposed to get everything instantly.
Well, absolutely true. And look at how short our attention span as a culture has become with instant electronic devices and constant use of texting and emails and cell phone and all that. I teach university students here, and I can't get them to concentrate, pay attention more than a millisecond, to use a figure of speech. I clearly see a huge drop in attention span of college students these days compared to 10, 20 years ago. You've got to, of course, be inventive and interactive with students in class to get them to really think through things. But there's a change in our culture about that.
You know, it's interesting because I was reading the American Psychological Association Monitor.
Yeah,
and I have a pile of them. I don't know, for like 3 or 4 years, and I picked one up and I read it every once in a while. And right. I don't know, I don't remember which one this was, but there was a whole series of articles on why college professors have to inject more humor into their lectures. It was interesting to me that it's not that you now have to teach, you also have to entertain.
There is some of that. Yeah, and pastors, by the way, say the same thing sometimes, that there is a little bit of entertainment and humor and even the delivery of their sermons. And that's well known. And here, me in Tennessee, living in the Bible Belt, you hear a lot about that. But typically, there really is a need. If you're going to address a group of listeners, listening is typically a passive information processing issue. It's passive. And so you've got to wake up the nervous system, in quotes, wake up the nervous system, and get people to acknowledge stimuli that's going to be interesting to them. So it really is a different effort. And then if you use your PowerPoints, you've got just lines of narrative up there on screen. People are taking notes. That's not necessarily thinking. It's very robotic. It's not a lot of inventive thinking. So yeah, you do have to get creative, ask questions, get people actively involved in the material, interact with them. It's not just, if you're going to rely on rote lecture, you're going to lose half your students right away.
And let me remind the audience again that I'm talking to Dr. Mark Angell from the Department of Health and Human Performance at Middle Tennessee State University. What suggestions and recommendations do you have for the more, resistant individuals? How do you really hook them?
Oh, what a great question. And what a difficult one to answer. But there's something called the bottom line, Howie. And the bottom line is that it's just not about us anymore. It's not about what we want and what we need as individuals. It's about the people who love us, the people who need us, the people to whom we feel responsible. And typically, those are our families. Nothing, and in my own consultations and readings, what seems to stick out is that to change health behavior, we've got to get people to acknowledge that it's not just you that concerns the medical community and who you should be concerned about in terms of your quality of life and your health. It's also the people who need you and love you. Think of your children. Think of your partners. Think of the people who depend on you in your employment environment. Think of your religious leaders. This is, and if you want to be a little bit more altruistic, think of the cost to the country that you are about to create due to your unhealthy habits, that you will in fact cost this country a lot of money in trying to maintain your health and sustain life. So it's not about you only. So when I get people to really think about their families and envision that the consequences, long-term consequences of their unhealthy habits is really not about not being accessible to their family, having their family, having to take care of them, be dependent on their family, for healthcare, costing your retirement becomes evaporated. All the years you spent in saving for retirement, 60 to 80% of that's going to be wiped out in healthcare costs because of your failure to look after your health earlier in life. So, and well, what's that going to do to your family and the kind of lifestyle you want to have later in life? So if you get people to really acknowledge who is important to them and how those people who are important to them will be affected by their poor health, their lack of healthy habits, and to really look at it as an investment in a happy future. I want to say one more thing, by the way, about how I get people to change behavior. There are two sources of information in health behavior change that have been relatively neglected in our attempts to change healthy habits, and that's physicians or healthcare professionals, and the other one are the religious leaders, mm-hmm. the rabbis, the pastors, the ministers, priests, etc. These are two areas. The physicians can do a much better job of giving their patients a sense of urgency about changing healthy habits, and many of them refuse to because they don't want to offend their patients, they don't want to lose their patients. After all, patients are a source of income, and they don't want to do anything that's going to appear to be offensive. And maybe they don't even see it as their job, but rather as a source of taking care of people, or not preventing, but rather rehabilitating people. So physicians have been a little negligent in this area. The religious leaders have been, with few exceptions, just absent from their responsibility in using scripture as a vehicle to change healthy habits. And someone told me that there were 36 passages in the Old and New Testament, 36 passages that directly relate to living a healthy lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And gluttony is one of the biggest components in scripture, and how sacrilegious it is to be gluttonous, and too much eating, and what kind of food to eat, this sort of thing. And religious leaders, many of whom themselves don't have healthy habits, have ultimately refused to address this issue in many of their sermons. And again, they don't want to lose members, they don't want to offend people, their feeling is they want to promote the Lord and scripture that pontificates the virtues of leading a religious lifestyle. All that's great. But without energy, without good health, and without sustaining life, you don't have your followers, whether it's Lord Jesus, it's God, it's Muhammad, whoever your Lord is, if you are a believer, if you are, clearly, you owe it to, your faith to be healthy. And that is often negligent by religious leaders. And there's a journal called Journal of Religion and Health in which these articles, come out and support this view.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking there's another complete side that has to be addressed as well, and that is education in terms of, you know, public education. And I know schools have, you know, phys ed programs and, you know, they tend to talk about health issues, but I'm not sure that they focus on it as much as they should.
Well, I'm gonna come across as a little cynical here, Howie, and some of your listeners might say, doesn't this guy have anything positive to say about anybody? Mm-hmm. And of course, there are a lot of teachers, and I am, my background, my bachelor's degree is in physical education, even though my graduate work is in human performance psychology. And there are a lot of people in the field of physical education who are doing an excellent job promoting fitness in the schools, and sure, the states have to do a better job of getting our kids more active in schools, with recesses and PE, physical education classes, etc. But also there's a lot of the opposite going on, in which not only are physical education classes being reduced and taken away, but our physical education teachers are not doing two things. Number one, they're not teaching sports skills as good as they should be to make sure the kids leave their classes with good capability of being able to play sport on their own time, as even lifetime habits. We need to do a better job in just teaching skills, including those kids that are just a little uncoordinated and really need the help and are overweight and really mm-hmm. need to learn how to play sports and make it more enjoyable. That's number one. Number two, we don't do a good job of fitness testing and having fitness programs in our schools. Many of our physical education teachers are not trained to lead exercise properly and are not trained to give fitness tests. I know this for a fact because I am in a department that teaches emerging PE teachers, and many of them do not take fitness as part of their preparation and are not taught how to give exercise and are not taught how to test fitness. Now, many are, but many are not. So we don't have a very fitness-rich curriculum in the existing physical education classes. Unless we do, unless we really hold physical education teachers accountable to improving student fitness, then the whole issue of physical education in the schools has become negligible, because it's not going to really make a difference. So we've got to do two things. One is increase the number of opportunities for physical activity in the schools. Number two, make sure our teachers are held accountable. And no more of this rolling out the ball and let kids have free play, but rather teach skills, do fitness tests, and not only test once, but test twice, early in the semester, late in the semester, and see if fitness scores have improved. There's a science to improving exercise and fitness, and our teachers need to do it. They need to practice the science.
You know, I have to tell you, Mark, that I work in a school district in addition to my practice.
Right.
And I have to say, my PE teacher does all of that stuff.
You know, that is exactly what you'd see more of doing, and I can tell you that we need to hold people accountable to
right.
that. The fact that they're doing it, I think, is spectacular, and more of that is absolutely necessary.
But what I do find, though, is, and this is probably statewide, if not nationwide, is
yep.
like New York State has mandated amount of PE time during the week. But when it comes to scheduling, I don't think you can get the required time out, because there's so many other demands that these kids have to face that the PE requirement just gets thrown by the wayside.
Yeah, and what I'm hearing from the teachers in Tennessee is that the No Child Left Behind programs and the reliance on improving math and science scores is really become an academic exercise in improving student performance in the classroom. And the whole fitness aspect and physical activity aspect has really gone by the sideline just for those reasons. But, you know, there's something called after-school physical education or after-school activities, and, you know, they're not easy to fund. I did run a few myself. I got a grant from a professional sports team, the Nashville Predators ice hockey team, to run an after-school exercise program. The kids will go there if exercise is offered and games are offered after class.
Mm-hmm.
And you get them staffed, and you can make sure the kids' safety is looked after. The kids will be picked up at the proper time and place, but you get the structure in there. The students will be interested. They will show up. And even if your local community centers, boys and girls clubs, fitness clubs, will sponsor at least once a week,
mm-hmm.
if not twice a week, these after-school activities. Again, as long as you get transportation to these facilities, the youngsters will go there. They do want it, and they will respond.
You know, unfortunately, at least what I see here is that because of the economy, both parents are working, and there's not the same kind of supervision that there was years ago.
Yeah.
Kids are left to their own devices much more frequently, and what they do is they tend to, play in the house. And you know, what I say to parents is, you know, your kid has very little physical activity and muscle strength, but he could probably kill you with his thumbs.
That's exactly right.
and they just don't really get that, you know, in the long term, these kids really need to be physically active much more than they are.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about active parenting now. And,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things that's worked in the disconnected values model, since family is such an important value, and let's face it, your children, I would say to parents, are your legacy. That's who you leave behind after you die. And even if you go to heaven, no matter what your belief system is, what's going to promote you in terms of making a difference on this planet after you're gone in the physical life? And your kids is often the answer. So it's part of the investment in their future. That is part of your legacy, and that means if it means picking up your child and actually going to going biking together or driving them to a fitness facility or some other activity, or carpool it and work with other parents so you don't have to do that every day, but get your kids involved in some activity after school. If it means picking them up from school and bringing them somewhere, not home, not in front of the TV, but to some organized activity, well, you know, this is part of the responsibility of parenting. It's going to be challenging, no question about it. And with two working parents, that you know, maybe you guys, I would say, people put some money together and get someone involved in picking these kids up and going to a facility. It's got to be planned, and it kind of has to be inventive. But there are church groups, synagogue groups, there are boys and girls clubs. All of them have after school activities. And maybe this is where the churches and synagogues and other religious institutions can help promote health by having activities at their facilities that involved improving fitness and exercise. Even a meeting at sports facilities,
mm-hmm.
Church-sponsored sports programs. All this can happen if the adults in charge are genuinely interested.
I agree. Mark, we're out of time.
Okay.
So I want to thank you for this discussion about the disconnected values model, and can change unhealthy habits into better habits. And so I appreciate the information. I want to remind the audience that this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In, and I'm talking to Mark Anschell, Professor of Department of Health and Human Performance at Middle Tennessee State University. Mark, I want to thank you again.
You're welcome, Howie.
Until next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at www.drsgurr.com.